Numbers chapter 6. We're in verses 1 through 21. I'm going to read through this section. You'll notice that we're stopping just one paragraph short of the end of the chapter. The end of the chapter caps off chapters 5 and 6, which we'll remind ourselves of in just a moment. Caps it off with the priestly blessing. We're going to give a Sunday to that next week because it's too good to rush through this material. So follow along with me as I read, and then we'll spend some time listening and considering to what the Lord has to say. Number 6:1, again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to dedicate himself to the Lord, he shall abstain from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar, whether made from wine or strong drink. Will offer one for a sin offering for the people, an example of what the ideal Israelite is to look like. The ideal state, the ideal condition would be for God's people to be like a people full of Nazarites, devoted to the Lord. And all of this, don't lose sight of the fact, don't mistake, or don't lose track of the idea that the reason that you want to pursue purity, the reason that you don't want to be undefiled, is because of what comes at the very end of chapter 6, which is where we'll be next week. All of this is for the benefit, is for the advantage of living in the presence of the Lord with His blessing. If you are defiled, you cannot draw near to the Lord. If you are contaminated, you cannot be in His presence. And if you persist in your defilement, you certainly will not live under the blessing of the Lord. The Lord is the goal. His presence, His blessing is the object. So we're going to take this in three ways. One, we're going to look at the dedication that the Nazarite gives to the act of service. When it talks about taking a Nazarite vow, right, most of the attention is given to what a Nazarite cannot do, or some of the things that distinguish him from the rest of the people. But we want to see that, but in conjunction with the idea that a Nazarite is separating himself for the sake of serving the Lord. So, number one, dedicated to service. That's in verses 1 through 8. Number two, we're going to see how the Lord handles issues in which his dedication is defiled. That's in verses 9 through 12. And then the last portion, verses 13 through 21, we want to see what it looks like when the Nazarite's dedication to the Lord reaches its fulfillment or its intended goal. So number one, dedicated to service. Look back with me at the beginning of chapter 6. In verse 2, when a man or woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to dedicate himself to the Lord, then it says he will do these things. All right? The point that I want to try to drive home to you right now is not explicit in the text, but I think it's there clearly upon further reflection, that the Nazarite vow is not first and foremost that a Nazarite promises that he's not going to have, there's going to be no alcohol, no razor, and no death. That's not the vow. That's what accompanies the vow. Do you understand? All right, so if you know a little bit of the Old Testament, the one person who is explicitly said to be a Nazarite in the Old Testament is Samson. He's not exactly the best example of what a Nazarite ought to be. Nevertheless, he's a Nazarite. He's not to drink alcohol. He's not to cut his hair. He's not to be contaminated by death. But here's the point. Samson is a good example in this respect. Samson is a Nazarite. He has been uniquely dedicated to the Lord in service to the Lord and his people. He is devoted to the Lord as a judge, as a deliverer for the people. So the vow of a Nazarite is not merely, well, I promise not to drink, not to cut my hair, not to go to a funeral. Those are signs and indications that you have taken the Nazirite vow. But the Nazirite vow in and of itself is twofold. It is a giving of yourself to the Lord in service to the Lord. Do you see? Do you understand? All right, this becomes very relevant to us because it's not merely the Nazirite in chapter 6 who is called to be separate and in service to the Lord, but all of God's people are called to do that. It's just that the Nazirite makes it crystal clear what this separation and service ought to include, what it's moving towards at the end of the day. So, the commitment to the Nazirite vow is a commitment to separate yourself to the Lord in His service for the benefit of the people. Then you have in, what is that, verse 3, starting in verse 3, the three marks, distinguishing characteristics that make a Nazirite easy to spot or easy to identify. No wine, no haircuts, no death. Why those three things? No wine. One of the things that we could say is that it is worth reflecting on the idea that there are unique ways in which the descriptions and the assignments given to the Nazirite are similar to some of the very descriptions and requirements that are given to the priesthood. Similar, but also then in some respects also very different. So, for example, the priests are allowed to drink wine, but they can't drink wine when they're going into the tabernacle to perform their priestly duties as a means of protection. They need to be sober-minded when they enter in to do the Lord's service for the sake of the people so that they don't make a mess of things, and rather than bring a blessing on God's people, they bring wrath instead. Something like that is probably at play with the Nazirite as well. He gives up for the period of his vow, for the duration of his service, he gives up alcohol, at least in one respect, because he too, like the priest who has been specially dedicated to the Lord, is going to serve the Lord in a sober-minded, clear-headed way. But there's also probably something else that goes with this. It is interesting that even the priests are allowed to drink so long as they're not going into the tabernacle to serve, but the Nazirite here is not allowed to drink at all. It doesn't matter where he is or who he's with. So long as he operates under this vow, you're not to touch alcohol. Why is that? I don't think it's because alcohol was sinful, but rather just the opposite. In the Old Testament, wine is frequently symbolic of joy and celebration and blessing and God's providential care being showered on His people, right? It's a celebration. It's feast-like language. So that along with the sober-mindedness, what the Nazirite is doing is showing that for a specific period of time, he is giving his life over to the Lord in such a way that he is willing to forego the normal joys and blessings of life for the sake of finding greater joy and blessing in his service to the Lord. Does that make sense? It's not that these other joys over here are wrong. It's not that they're sinful. It's not that other people can't do that. But for this particular period of time, this man knowingly, willfully is saying, my only concern is pursuing the service of the Lord, and that's where my joy and my satisfaction is going to be found. No wine. No haircuts. Why no haircuts? This is most clearly symbolic. When you look, if you go down, let's see, where is it? Verse 6, the end of verse 6. No, I'm sorry, the end of verse 7. When it's talking about how the Nazirite will not make himself unclean for his father or mother, You see that interesting phrase, the very last line of verse 7? Because his separation to God is on his head. His separation to God is on his head. The head stands for the whole, right? The way that you typify, or in this provision, the way that you signify that all of your life has been given over to the Lord is by not letting anyone touch your head. You have given your life over to the Lord. The head represents the whole. Therefore, you're going to let the hair on the head grow long as a way to show that no one touches me or no one interferes with this vow that I've given to the Lord. The head stands for the whole. The long hair is a sign of the vow of separation and dedication to the Lord. This is also why when you read at the end of the passage, when the days of the vow have been fulfilled, what does the Nazarite do with his hair? He cuts the hair and does what with it? He puts it in the fire at the altar and incorporates the hair in the sacrificial offering. Why does he do that? Because if the head represents the whole, the hair represents the Nazarite giving his life over, laying it on the altar for the Lord. I have completed my service. I have given myself totally to the Lord. Do you see? And then the third one, no alcohol, no haircuts, no death. You cannot come near someone who has died, not even your immediate family, not even your father or mother or brother or sister. The only other person who had this kind of restriction placed on him was the high priest himself. Even the other priests could attend to the death of immediate family members. The high priest alone was forbidden from contaminating himself with death under any circumstances. The Nazarite then, in similar fashion, is so uniquely dedicated to the Lord that, like the high priest, even when an immediate family member dies, he must separate himself from death, because death is one of the primary and chief contaminants that defiles you and makes you unfit for the presence of the Lord. Anyone want to sign on for a Nazarite vow? Anyone want to give up the joys of life, the parties of this world, your cosmetology, hairdressing, separating yourself even from the sorrows of this world? Do you notice, though, that at the very beginning of number 6, who is this vow, this way of life, who is this open to? Verse 2, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or woman, anyone can take on the vow of a Nazarite. Anyone. God opens up this kind of dedication and separation to anyone among his people. Anyone can do it. How many people do it? Very few. And the very few who do it only do it for a very distinct, set portion of time. But if this is the ideal, why don't more of God's people do it? Right? You're tracking with chapter 5, where those who are defiled separate themselves from the camp. If that's at one end of the extreme, that the defiled have to be separated from the Lord and from his people, the other positive end of the extreme is of a people who are totally devoted to the Lord, who avoid contamination and defilement at any cost, and who find all of their joy and all of their meaning and expend all of their energy into serving the Lord. Why wouldn't everyone want to do that? I don't know how to give a rock solid, airtight answer to that. I'll say this. If I am Old Testament Israel in the camp and I hear about the vow of a Nazirite, you want to know the reason why I don't do it? Because it's hard. Because it means that I'm going to be giving some things up. It means that I might miss out on some things or some people or some events. You see, right? You begin to weigh the cost of what it means to be wholly dedicated and separated to the Lord in comparison to what I can keep or what I can enjoy if I don't take that vow. But see, do you hear how that begins to fall on your ears? What you're beginning to do, if you are reading this attentively, you're beginning to realize that your heart is weighing in the balance the value of being devoted to the Lord versus the value of being devoted to the things of this life. And where does that leave you? You understand that this is not this idea of separation and devotion and commitment. This is not something that's limited or relegated to Numbers chapter 6. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6 that no man can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You remember a couple chapters later, if you've been with us in our Sunday morning Bible study before the service, we're going through Matthew. Remember in Matthew chapter 8, when Jesus is about to get into the boat to go to the other side, two men come to him asking to follow Jesus. One of the men says, Jesus, let me bury my father first and I will come with you. What does Jesus say? Allow the dead to bury the dead. And later, if you don't hate father and mother and sister and brother for the sake of loving and following me, you're not worthy to be my disciple. Do you hear that? Do you think Jesus, in his call to discipleship and devotion, lessens the pressure, lessens the intensity? And it's not just Jesus. Look, hold your place in Numbers. Go to Philippians chapter 3. Philippians 3, look at verses 7 and 8 with me. But whatever things were gained to me, those things I have counted as loss for the sake of Christ. More than that, I count all things to be lost in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and count them rubbish, garbage, so that I may gain Christ. And then look fearfully later in Philippians 3. Look at verses 18 and 19. For many walk, of whom I often told you and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their appetite, whose glory is in their shame, who set their minds on earthly things. Good things can kill you just like bad things can kill you. Good things can kill you when you weigh the good things, things that ought to be turning your mind back to Christ, back to God. Good things kill you when you put them and you weigh them in the balance of the surpassing value of knowing Christ, and you consider these good things to be more valuable, to be more precious than Christ. When you find yourself willing to compromise and to stop following Christ when the path gets difficult because you fear that you're going to lose this person or that position, good things will kill you. I could get more of Christ. I could devote myself to Him more, but I gotta have this app. I gotta have this iPhone. I gotta have this vacation. I gotta have this possession. Do you see? You put Christ in the balance and you find Him lacking compared to the things of this world. And one of the good, necessary things that number six gives us is it says, this is the way. This is the way that God's people ought to live every day. Totally devoted to the Lord and to the service of His people, because they find the joy in service to the Lord far outweighs any of the lesser, cheaper things. Good things, comfortable things that we're not willing to let go of are killing us. But the challenge that you have when you come back to number six, so if you're still in Philippians, go back to number six. The challenge is, I read number six, is that I'm confronted right away with the fact that I find that my heart, more often than what I want to admit, is far weaker than what I want it to be. Right? My heart just does not, on its own, my heart does not naturally want to go in this direction, because I like comfort. I like familiarity. I like the things of this world. But as you continue to read and you go to the second section in verses 9 through 12, even if you wanted to be this devoted to the Lord, you still run into the issue of defilement and contamination that you have no control over. Did it sound odd to you that in verses 9 through 12, the scenario that's presented is a Nazarite who accidentally comes into contact with death because someone who is beside him, perhaps walking on the road, sitting at the table, who knows what the situation is, just keels over, maybe from a heart attack, and dies? You know what happens then? If you've committed yourself to a year-long vow and you're at day 364 and your buddy at the desk next to you keels over of a heart attack and dies, you have to go back to zero and start all over again because your vow has been contaminated by the defilement of death. You didn't intend for that to happen. You aren't looking for someone to die right next to you. But more than that, as strange as what and as severe as what that sounds, did you also notice in verse 11 that in order for the Nazarite to put himself back on the path of devotion to the Lord, fulfilling his vow, he has to bring sacrifices. He has to be cleansed. Verse 11 says that the priest will offer a sin offering and a burnt offering and make atonement for him, that is the Nazarite, concerning his sin because of the dead person. What is that? God is going to fault this man because someone next to him died? See, here's the point, people. Defilement is defilement whether you will it to be or not. Right? Listen, this is why this is important. Because there is a strand of thought in Christian circles that would tell you that so long as the desires or the thoughts or the impulses that course through your mind or your heart, so long as they are not wanted, they are not defiling. And that is not true. Anything that falls short of God's perfection is sin. Any movement towards sin is sin, even if you don't act on it. The impulse, the desire itself is contaminating and defiling. Once again, listen to Jesus. Jesus is confronting the idea that the only thing that matters when it comes to being pure before the Lord is this ritual, ceremonial purity that limits itself to the kind of food that you eat or whether or not you wash your hands before you eat it. And do you remember what Jesus says? Jesus says it's what comes from the heart that defiles a man. Even if you wanted to live a life of complete dedication and service to the Lord, you are unqualified to do so because in your heart there are all kinds of defilements that rear up every single day. You remember what Paul says in Romans 7? Paul is talking about the fact that when he looks at the law of the Lord, he sees that it is holy and righteous and good. But then he says, the problem is that even as I acknowledge that this is right, do you know what happens? I am so sinful that when the law tells me not to covet, do you know what I find my heart doing? I find my heart coveting. The very things that I don't want are the things that I chase after. The things that I don't want to do are the things that I end up doing. Do you hear that? And so what does Paul say? Does Paul say, oh, no matter, because I didn't really want to do that. That's not really the real me. Or does Paul say, wretched man that I am, who will save me from the body of this death? Who? Thanks be to God, who saves us through Jesus Christ. You realize, of course, there has only ever been, in all of biblical history, in all of redemptive history, there has only been one true Nazarite. Only one. And it's not you, and it's not me. There has only been, in all of redemptive history, one true Nazarite who has so devoted himself to the will of God and in service to the people of God that he lived all of his days completely separate and devoted to doing the work of God. And he lives every moment of every day bombarded with temptation, and he never sins. He never is defiled. And better than the Nazarite in the Old Testament, who comes to the end of his vow, who has committed himself to the service of the Lord and to his people, reaches the end of his vow and his fulfillment, and what does he do to signify that he has done that? What does he offer up of himself? Hair. Hair. We got to do better than hair. Right? Hebrews 10. Turn to Hebrews 10. The Nazarite comes to the end of his vow. He comes into the tabernacle area with sacrifices and offerings, and he offers his hair as a sign that he has fulfilled his vow to give himself, his body and his life, totally in service to the Lord. Tell me if you don't hear something better in Hebrews 10. Hebrews 10:5. Therefore, when he comes into the world, that is referring to Christ, when he comes into the world, he says, sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book, it is written of me to do your will. Verse 10, by this will we have been sanctified, set apart, through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. How do we know that Jesus made good on his devotion to the Lord and fulfilled his mission? Because, just like the Nazarite in chapter 6, it ends with a sacrifice. It ends with Jesus offering up his own body on the cross in obedience to the Father and in ultimate service and sacrifice to the people of God. And then listen, here's how it works. Romans 12, because we have been crucified with Christ, because we have been united with him, therefore Paul can use language in Romans 12 like this. I urge you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies, what? A living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God, which is your spiritual act of worship. See, it's not that because Jesus has been the true and better Nazarite, because Jesus was perfectly devoted and separated, because Jesus perfectly fulfilled the law and the covenants, therefore now we just sit back and don't do anything. We have been crucified with Christ, and yet we live. Yet it's not us, but Christ who lives in us. That dedication and devotion of Christ that is exemplified climactically in the self-giving on the cross is the kind of devotion and dedication and self-giving that Christ compels us to do as we live devoted and sanctified to him, no matter what the cost. Finding your joy and your satisfaction and your fulfillment in communion with God and in service to him will always be far better than anything else this world or this life has to offer. And all of this gets us ready. This idea of devotion and purity and sanctification, all of this is whetting our appetite to hear it said, what it is that we gain for that purity at the end of number 6. It's nothing less than the smile and the glory and the blessing of God on his people. You cannot buy that kind of joy. I hope you'll be back next week. Let's pray. Father, would you, in the course of renewing our minds day by day and strengthening the new hearts that you have given us, cause us to see this world as pale and shallow in comparison to the glories of Christ and the world to come. May we not be shaken or dismayed or dissuaded from any sacrifice that might seem too difficult, but that we would consider the reward, and that we would be a people who would show ourselves to be devoted to Christ because of the devotion in which he has given himself to us. We pray this in his name. Amen.